He took his box of candy and went jauntily down the steps of Western Biological. Crossing the street, he knew he was being observed from every window from which he was visible, and he didn't care. He waved a salute to his unseen audience. Going through the vacant lot among the mallow weeds, he thought, "How do you knock on an iron door?" He stooped and picked a rusty tenpenny nail from the ground, and he arrived almost gaily at the boiler and tapped a little drumbeat on the iron wall. The fire door was slightly ajar. Susie's voice sounded with a metallic ring. "Who is it?"
"It's I," said Doc.
"Or me. Somebody like that." The fire door opened and Susie looked out.
"Thanks for the flowers," she said.
"I bought you another present." She looked at the candy box in his hand. Being on her hands and knees, she had to twist her neck to look up at him. Doc couldn't tell whether there was suspicion and doubt on her face or only strained muscles from her position.
"Candy?" she asked.
"Yes."
"I don't..."
she began, and then Fauna's words crowded in on her with short punches.
"What the hell?" she said.
"Thanks." Doc was losing his poise. Susie had straightened her neck, and from her position she couldn't see above his knees. Doc tried for lightness again, and he sounded clumsy to himself. "This is a formal call," he said. "Aren't you going to ask me in?"
"Do you think you can get in?"
"I can try."
"There ain't much room inside."
Doc remained silent.
"Oh, for God's sake, come on in," said Susie.
She backed her head out of the opening. Doc got down on his hands and knees. He threw the candy box through the fire door, then crawled through the opening. He thought with amusement, a man who can do this with dignity need never again fear anything. And at that moment his trouser cuff caught on the door and pulled it closed against his ankle. He was all inside except one foot, and he could not free himself. "I seem to be hung up," he said.
"Hold it," said Susie.
She straddled him and worked the cuff loose from the door corner.
"I think you tore your pants," she said as she backed off over his shoulders. "Maybe I can mend them for you."
Doc's eyes were getting used to the dim interior. A little light came in from the smokestack and met a little more that entered from the fire door.
"It's hard to see at first," said Susie. "I got a lamp here. Wait, I'll light it up."
"No need," said Doc. He could see now, and something in him collapsed with pity at the pretension of the curtains, the painted walls, and the home-built dressing table with its mirror and bottles. "My God, what a brave thing is the human," he thought. And then Susie brought his rising compassion crashing down.
"There's a welder eats at the poppy. Know what he's going to do first any day he can? Bring his torch and cut windows in the sides."
Her voice echoed with enthusiasm. "I'll put in little window frames and some flower boxes with red geraniums," she said. "Of course I'll have to paint the outside then. White, I think, with green trim. Maybe a trellis like in front. I got a nice hand with roses." Then she was silent. Constraint and formality sifted in and filled the boiler. Doc thought in wonder, it's not a boiler at all. Somehow she has managed to make a home of this. He said, "You've done a wonderful job here."
"Thanks."
He spoke his thought. "It's a real home."
"It's comfortable," she said. "I had never had no room of my own."
"Well,
you have now. Sometimes I sat in here and think how they'd have to blast to get me out if I didn't want to come. Doc gathered his courage.
Susie, I'm sorry for what happened.
I don't want to talk about it. It wasn't none of your fault.
Yes, it was.
I don't think so, she said with finality.
I would do anything to... Look, Doc, she said, you won't let it alone, so maybe I gotta rub your nose in it a little.
It was no fault of yours, but it sure as hell give me a lesson. I had myself a ball, and now it's done. There ain't nothing for you to do. I don't need nothing. Anybody sorry for me, they're wasting their time. I ain't never had it so good in my life. Got that? Well, don't forget it. There ain't nothing for you nor nobody to do, 'cause I'm doing it all myself. If you can get that through your knocker, okay. If you can't, you better take a powder.
He said, what a conceited fool I've been.
Then silence hung in the boiler. Susie broke it when she felt that his nose was sufficiently rubbed in it.
Know what? She said brightly. They got a night class, typing, at the high school. I signed up. Next Saturday I get a rent typewriter. I can learn.
I'll bet you can, too. Maybe you'll type my paper for me.
You're going to write it, after all?
I've got to, Susie. It's all I have. I'm a dead duck without it. I'm going to La Jolla Saturday for the spring tides. I'm glad.
Are you?
Why not? She asked. I don't like to see nobody kicked in the face.
She drew up formality like a coverlet.
You want I should make you a nice cup of tea? I got a Sterno stove.
I'd like it.
She had the situation in hand now, and she talked on easily while she lighted the stove and put a little tea kettle on to boil.
I'm making good tips down at the Poppy, she said. Paid off Joe Blakey in 2 weeks. Ella's thinking about taking a week's vacation. She had never had a vacation. Hell, I can run the joint easy. Excuse that hell. I don't hardly never cuss no more.
You're doing fine, said Doc. Could you tell me, without rubbing my nose in it, what you want in a man? Might help me another time.
Tea's ready, said Susie.
She passed him the steaming cup.
Leave it steep a little longer, she said. Sugar's in the cup on the dressing table.
When he was stirring the sugar in, she said, if I thought it wasn't a pitch you was making, I'd tell you.
I don't think it's a pitch.
Okay, then. Maybe what I want isn't anywhere in the world, but I want it, so I think there is such a thing. I want a guy that's wide open. I want him to be a real guy. Maybe even a tough guy, but I want a window in him. He can have his dukes up every other place, but not with me. And he got to need the hell out of me. He got to be the kind of guy that if he ain't got me, he ain't got nothing. And brother, that guy's gonna have something.
Except for toughness, you're kind of describing me, said Doc.
You keep out of this. You told me, and I was too dumb to listen. You like what you got. You told me straight. I'd spoil it. Took me a long time to wise up, but I sure wised up.
Maybe what I said wasn't true.
When you said it with your face, it was true, all right.
Doc felt beaten. There was no anger in her tone, nothing but acceptance, together with an undertone of excitement. That was it, excitement, almost amounting to gaiety.
He said, you know, Susie, you sound happy.
I am, said Susie. And you know who done it for me?
Who?
Fauna. That's a hunk of dame. She made me proud, and I ain't never been proud before in my life."
"How did she do it?" Doc asked. "I need some of that myself."
"She told me, and made me say it, there ain't nothing in the world like Susie. And she says, Susie is a good thing. And goddammit, it's true. Now let's knock it off, huh?"
"Okay," said Doc. "I guess I ought to be going."
"Yeah," said Susie. "I gotta go to work. Say, remember that guy you told me about that lived out where we went that night?"
"The seer?"
"Sure. What about him?" "Joe Blakey had to pick him up."
"What for?"
"Stealing. From the Safeway store. Joe hated to do it."
"I'll see what I can do. So long, Susie."
"You ain't mad?"
"No, Susie. But I'm sorry."
"So am I. But hell, you can't have everything. So long, Doc. Hope you do good at La Jolla."
When Doc crossed the street this time, he hoped no one was watching. He went into the laboratory, walked to his cot, and lay down. He was sick with loss. He couldn't think. Only one thing was sure. He had to go to La Jolla. If he didn't, he would die, because there would be nothing left in him to believe in, even to defend. He squinched his eyes closed and looked at the bright points of light swimming on his retinas. There were footsteps on his porch, and the snakes whirred their rattles, but not violently. Hazel opened the door and looked in. He saw Doc's expression, and the hope died out of him.
"No soap?" he asked.
"No soap," said Doc.
"There got to be some way."
"There isn't," said Doc.
"Anything I can do?"
"No."
"Yes, there is too. You know Joe Blakey."
"The cop? Sure."
"Well, he picked up a man in the sand dunes. Find Joe and tell him I'm interested in the man. Tell him to be nice to him. I'll be down to see him as soon as I can. Tell Joe the man is harmless."
Doc rolled on his side and dug in his pocket. "Here's $2. Ask Joe to let you see the man and give him..."
"No, stop at the Safeway and buy a dozen candy bars and take them to the seer, and then give him the change."
"Seer?"
"That's the man's name," said Doc wearily.
"I'll do her right now," Hazel said proudly. He went out at a dog trot. Doc was arranging himself comfortably in his misery again when there was a knock on the door.
"Come in!"
he cried. There was no answer but a second knock and a wild buzzing from the snakes.
"Ah, Christ," said Doc. "I hope not school children on a culture tour."
It was a telegram, a long one. "Collect." It said, "Eureka, Greek word meaning I have found it. You are now an institution. Have set up cephalopod research section at California Institute of Technology. You are in charge. $6,000 a year and expenses. Get to work on your devilfish. Am making arrangements for you to read paper in California Academy Sciences at end of year. All clearly deductible. Congratulations. Wish I could hear your words when you have to pay for this wire." Doc laid the telegram beside him on the cot.
"The son of a bitch," he said. Chapter 36 Lama Sabachthani?
Hazel sat on the end of the steel cot in the Monterey jail and looked with interest at the seer. "Open up one of them baby Ruths," he said. "If you're a friend of Doc's, can't nothing bad happen to you."
"I don't know him," said the seer.
"Well, he knows you. That's your good luck."
"I don't know any doctors."
"He ain't that kind. He's a doctor of bugs and stuff like that."
"Oh, yes, I do remember. I gave him dinner."
"And he give you candy bars?"
"I probably won't eat them."
"Why, for Christ's sake, not?"
"Tell my friend Doc that greed poisoned me.
I love candy bars. I stole only one at a time and eased my conscience of a little crime. But yesterday an appetite like a whip overcame me. I stole three. The manager of the Safeway says he knew I was stealing one at a time. He let it go, but when I took three, he couldn't let it pass. I don't blame him. Who knows what I would have done next? Some other appetite might have driven me. I'll punish myself by smelling these bars and not eating them."
"I think you're nuts," said Hazel.
"I guess so. I have no basis of comparison, so I don't know how other people feel."
"You talk a little like Doc," said Hazel. "I don't get none of it."
"How is he?"
"Not too hot. He got troubles."
"Yes, I could see that. I remember now. He wore loneliness like a shroud. I was afraid for him."
"Jesus, you do talk like him. He got dame trouble."
"That was bound to be. When a man is cold, he looks for warmth. When he's lonely, there's only one cure."
"Why doesn't he take the woman?"
"She won't have him unless..."
"I see. Sometimes they're that way."
"Who?"
"Women."
"What do you mean, unless?"
Hazel looked at the seer with level, penetrating eyes. This man talked like Doc. Maybe he could help. But with this thought, there came also caution.
"I'd like to ask you something," Hazel said.
"What?"
"Well, this ain't none of it true. It's a kind of a whatchamacallit,
hypothetical question?"
"I guess so. Suppose there's a guy, and he's in trouble."
"Yes?"
"Well, he can't get out of it, but he got a friend maybe he don't know about."
"That's you," said the seer.
"No, it ain't. It's some other guy. I forget his name."
He hurried on.
"Well, suppose the guy's in trouble, and there's one way he can get out, but he can't do it. You think his friend ought to do it?"
"Certainly."
"Even if it hurt like hell?"
"Certainly."
"Even if it might maybe not work?"
"Certainly." "I don't know what the situation is with your doc, but I know how it should be with you. If you love him, you must do anything to help him. Anything. Even kill him to save him incurable pain. This is the highest and most terrible duty of friendship. I gather that what you must do is violent. You must first make sure it can be successful, and you must, second, make sure within yourself that you know you will be punished. It's quite possible that even if you are successful, your friend will never speak to you again. That takes a lot of love. Maybe the greatest love. Make sure you love him that much."
Hazel caught his breath. "Hell, there ain't no such guy. It's hypo..."
It's malarkey. A kind of riddle.
I guess you do love him that much, the seer said. No one knows how greatness comes to a man. It may lie in his blackness, sleeping, or it may lance into him like those driven fiery particles from outer space. These things, however, are known about greatness. Need gives it life and puts it in action. It never comes without pain. It leaves a man changed, chastened, and exalted at the same time. He can never return to simplicity. Under the black cypress tree, Hazel writhed on the ground. From between his clenched teeth came little whimpers. As the night drew on and the moon went down, leaving blackness, so desolation fell on Hazel, so that he cried out against the agony of his greatness, as that other did, feeling forsaken. Hour after hour the struggle went on, and only about 3 o'clock in the morning was Hazel saturated. Then he accepted it as he had accepted the poisoned presidency of the United States. He was calm, for there was no escape. If anyone had seen him, it would have been a dull man who did not find him beautiful. Hazel picked his chosen instrument from the ground, an indoor ball bat. He crept like a night-collared cat out of the black shadow of the cypress tree. In less than 3 minutes he returned. He lay on his stomach under the tree and wept.
Chapter 37 Little Chapter.
Dr. Horace Dormady hated night calls like everybody else, but Doc was his friend, and he responded to the frenzied voice on the telephone. In the lab, he looked at Doc's white face and then at his right arm.
It's broken all right. I don't know how badly. Think you could get to my car? I want an X-ray.
And later he said,
Well, that's that. It's clean and it'll take time. Now tell me your cock and bull story again.
I was asleep, said Doc. Only thing I can think is that I must have turned over and it was caught between the cot and the wall.
You mean you weren't in a fight?
I tell you, I was asleep. What are you grinning about? What's so funny? Dr. Horace said,
Have it your own way. It's none of my business. Unless the other fellow shows up. The tissue over the break smashed. It looks as though it's been hit with a club.
I can't have it, Doc cried. I've got to go to La Jolla tomorrow for the spring tides.
And turn over rocks?
Sure.
Try and do it, said Dr. Horace. Is the cast getting hot?
Yes, said Doc despondently.
Chapter 38 Hoop-de-doodle 2 or The Pacific Grove Butterfly Festival. When things get really bad, there are some who seek out others who have it worse, for consolation. It's hard to see how this works, but it seems to. You balance your trouble against another's, and if yours is lighter, you feel better. You would say the situation in Cannery Row was just about hopeless. Consider, then, the plight of the town of Pacific Grove, and you will understand why the lights burned all night in the Masonic Hall, and why there was talk of getting rid of the city government. It wasn't a small thing. The whole town was involved. The butterflies had not arrived. Pacific Grove benefits by one of those happy accidents of nature that gladden the heart, excite the imagination, and instruct the young. On a certain day in the shouting springtime, great clouds of orangey monarch butterflies, like twinkling airy fields of flowers, sail high in the air on a majestic pilgrimage across Monterey Bay and land in the outskirts of Pacific Grove in the pine woods. The butterflies know exactly where they're going. In their millions, they land on several pine trees, always the same trees. There, they suck the thick, resinous juice which oozes from the twigs, and they get cockeyed. The first comers suck their fill and then fall, drunken, to the ground, where they lie like a golden carpet, waving their inebriate legs in the air and giving off butterfly shouts of celebration, while their places on the twigs are taken by new, thirsty millions. After about a week of binge, the butterflies sober up and fly away, but not in clouds. They face their Monday morning singly or in pairs. For a long time, Pacific Grove didn't know what it had. Then, gradually, it was remarked that an increasing number of tourists were drawn to see the butterflies. Where there are tourists, there is money, and it's a sin to let it drift away. Pacific Grove had a gravy train right in its lap, and the butterflies came free. It's only natural that the Great Butterfly Festival evolved, and where there's a festival, there is bound to be a pageant. There was ointment trouble at first. Pacific Grove is not only a dry town, but ardently dry. The sale of various tonics of good alcoholic content is the highest in the state, but there's no liquor. The fact that the visiting butterflies came to the dry oasis to get drunk seemed a little unfair, but the town solved this, first by ignoring it, and then by hotly denying it. The butterfly pageant explains the whole thing. There was once a butterfly princess, sung by Miss Graves, and she wandered away and was lost. Somehow a bunch of Indians, citizens in long brown underwear, got in it. I forget how. Anyway, the loyal subjects searched and searched, and at last they found their princess, and in their millions came to rescue her. When they lie flat on their backs, their legs are waving greetings to their queen. It all works out very nicely. The pageant is in the ballpark, and tourists can buy butterflies made out of every conceivable material, from pine cones to platinum. The town makes a very nice thing of it. Why, the symbol of Pacific Grove on its advertising is the monarch butterfly. In all history, there has been only one slip-up. In 1924, I think it was, the butterflies did not come, and the frantic town was forced to print hundreds of thousands of paper butterflies in two colors and spread them all over. Today, a wise city government keeps a huge supply of paper monarchs on hand in case tragedy should strike again. Now, the time of the arrival is set, give one or two days in either direction. The pageant has been practicing for months. The Indians are trained. The prince has his tights out of mothballs, and the princess flowers toward coloratura luxury. Perhaps it was an omen. 2 days before the insects were due, Miss Graves lost her voice. She was a nice young woman, rather pretty, and rather tired. She taught fourth grade, which is enough to tire anyone. Sprays and injections had no effect. Perhaps it was psychosomatic pressure that closed her throat and bottled up all but a dry squawk. Her eyes were feverish with despondency. And then the days went by, and the butterflies did not arrive. At first there was panic in Pacific Grove, and then a blind anger set in, and the citizens looked about for someone to blame. The city government was a pushover. It was time for a change. Storekeepers whose bookkeeping was shaky blamed it on the mayor. Moving picture attendance had fallen off. The city council took the rap for that. The matter became a growl, and the growl a roar. Turn the rascals out! Then there was a hotel fire in King City, 60 miles away, and guess who came boiling out with an overcoat and a blonde? Mayor Christie of Pacific Grove didn't even trouble to resign. He left town, and just as well. There was talk of tar and feathers. He must have heard. The town hadn't been so upset since the Great Roque War. The religious bloc blamed the whole thing on sin, without going into details. The cynics wanted to throw the whole council out, together with the chief of police and the water commissioner. More solid citizens placed the blame where it belonged, on Roosevelt Truman socialism. And the butterflies did not come. Then the first grade had its scandal. William Taylor IV brought his crayons home wrapped in the dust cover of the Kinsey Report. On being confronted, he panicked and said he got it from the teacher, Miss Buck. She was questioned, and it developed that her father had signed a petition for the release of Eugene V. Debs in 1918. It had got so nobody could trust anybody. And Miss Graves went on croaking, and the butterflies did not come. So you see, the trouble on Cannery Row wasn't as horrible as you thought. Chapter 39 Sweet Thursday Revisited. Again, it was a sweet Thursday in the spring. The sun took a leap toward summer and loosed the furled petals of the golden poppies. Before noon, you could smell the spice of blue lupins from the fields around Fort Ord. It was a sweet day for all manner of rattlesnakes. On the parade ground, a jackrabbit, crazy with spring, strolled in March hare madness across the rifle range and drew joyous fire from two companies before he skidded to safety behind a sand dune. That jackrabbit's moment of grandeur cost the government $890 and gladdened the hearts of one hell of a lot of soldiers. Miss Graves awakened breathless with expectancy. She sang a scale in half-tones and found that her voice was back and all was well with the world. And she was right. At 11 o'clock, the monarch butterflies came boiling in from across the bay and landed in their millions on the pine trees, where they sucked the thick sweet juice and got cockeyed. The butterfly committee met an emergency session in the firehouse and got out the crowns of fairies and the long brown underwear of the Indians. The mayor pro tem of Pacific Grove wrote a proclamation for the evening paper. The tide was very low that morning, preparing for the spring tides, and the warm sun dried the seaweed so that billions of flies came on excursion to feed. People felt good. Judge Albertson discharged the seer on the recommendation of the Safeway manager. Dr. Horace Dormady whistled through his mask over an appendectomy and told a political joke to the anesthetist, but he didn't mention Doc's broken arm. A patient's problems, no matter how funny, were sacred to Dr. Horace, but he couldn't help chuckling discreetly to himself now and then. How did the word spread about Doc's arm? Who knows? Fauna heard it with her crullers. Alice, Mabel, and Becky got it with their orange juice. The patron heard it from Cacahuete, who thereupon rushed to the beach and played three loud and uninhibited choruses of Sweet Georgia Brown, using six changes of key. Wide Ida was siphoning Pine Canyon whiskey into Old Crow bottles when she heard it. Mac and the boys had the news early, and it gave them something pressing to do. Susie opened up the poppy that morning. The counter was crowded with breakfasters who dawdled over coffee. It was well into the morning before Susie heard that Doc had broken his arm. And then she couldn't do anything about it because Ella was getting a permanent. But after she heard it, some mid-morning customers got curious service from a Susie who looked blankly over their heads when they spoke to her. She called Mr. McMiniman Mr. Gross, and she called Mr. Gross you, and served his eggs straight up, which sickened him. Mac was first on the scene. He didn't even put on his shoes. He regarded the new cast, which still hadn't cooled off, and listened to the only explanation Doc could think of, that he had got his arm caught between the cot and the wall. "What are you going to do?" Mac asked. "I don't know. I have to get south. I have to." Mac was about to make an offer when a thought came to him that made him say, "Maybe something'll turn up." He bolted for the Palace Flophouse. Once there, he went to Hazel's bed and found it pristine and unwrinkled. "He ain't been in," said Whitey Number One. "Well, what do you think of that?" Mac said with admiration. "Why, the sweet son of a bitch." Mac went out to the cypress tree and crawled under its low-hanging limbs, and he dragged Hazel out the way you'd drag a puppy from under a bed, and half carried him up to the Palace Flophouse. Hazel was far gone in emotional fatigue.
"I had to,"
he said hopelessly. "Anybody seen Susie?" Mac asked. "I seen her go to work early," said Eddie. "Well, you better go break the news to her. Do it offhand," said Mac. "Now, Hazel, how'd you do it?"
"You mad with me?"
"Hell no," said Mac. "Of course, we don't know how she'll work out, but it's a step in the right direction." He turned to the two Whiteys. "I want you should notice Hazel didn't bust Doc's leg. That was good judgment. Doc can walk, but he can't work. You, Whitey," he said to Whitey Number Two, "I want you should get over to Doc's and hang around. If anybody offers to drive him down to La Jolla, you take care of it. Where's the indoor ball bat?"
"I throwed it in the bay," said Hazel.
"So that's what it was. Whitey, you get yourself a couple of feet of gas pipe." Hazel went into collapse. Mac sat on the edge of his bed and placed and replaced cold, damp rags on Hazel's feverish brow. Hazel struggled for speech. "Mac," he said, "I can't do her. I don't care if the stars or even the cops say I gotta. I can't do her. I ain't got the poop."
"What are you talking about? You already done her."
"I don't mean that. You tell Fauna she gotta get somebody else for President of the United States." Mac stared down at him in amazement. "I'll be damned," he said. "I thought you'd forgot."
"I practiced," said Hazel brokenly. "I don't want to let nobody down, Mac, but I just ain't no good at it. Try and get me off, will you, Mac? Please? Pretty goddamn please?"
Mac's eyes brimmed with compassion. "Well, you sweet bastard," he said. "You poor little rabbit. Don't you worry. Ain't nobody gonna force you. You done noble stuff. Wasn't nobody with guts but you.
It ain't oysters,"
Hazel said. Hell, I could do that. I'd eat old socks if I had to. It's just the job's too big for me. I'd mess up the whole country.
Max said, you just lay there, Hazel, baby. Max's going to take care of it. There ain't nobody brave as you. Whitey, he said to Whitey number one, you sit here on Hazel's bed and kind of pet him. Don't let him get up until I get back. And Mac hurried out.
You gotta do something and do it quick, Mac said to Fauna. Suppose Hazel gets another noble idea. Why, hell, he might kill somebody.
Yeah, said Fauna. I can see how it is. Just let me get my stuff together. You think he'd like a nice monkey head?
He'd love it, said Mac. He needs it.
Fauna held her chart in front of Hazel's eyes.
Anybody can make a mistake, she said. There was a fly speck on the chart. Saturn wasn't in the bicuspid at all.
Hazel said suspiciously, how do I know you ain't malarking me now just to make me feel good?
How many toes you got?
I counted 'em. 9.
Count 'em again.
Hazel slipped off his shoes.
Looks like the same as before, he said.
Look at that little toe kind of bent under. Hell, Hazel, I may have made a mistake with a fly speck, but you miscounted your toes. You got 10. One bent under.
A slow smile began to spread over Hazel's face. A smile of relieved delight. Then, for a moment, the shadow of worry came back.
Who you think they'll get instead of me?
Nobody knows, said Fauna.
Well, he better be good, said Hazel ominously. And then he abandoned himself to pure relief. I got a little shadow that goes in and out with me, he sang.
Fauna rolled up her chart and went home. Just before noon, the expressman picked his unaccustomed way up to the chicken walk to the palace flophouse.
I got a great big crate for you guys, he said. I ain't got no call to deliver it up a rope ladder. Come on down and get it.
It's here, Mac cried. God works in his tum-to-tum way his tum-tums to perform.
Hazel and Whitey number one and Mac were wrestling the big wooden case up the chicken walk when Eddie joined them.
Susie come, he cried. I come with her. Seemed like she was about to take off any minute. She's in there with him now.
Give us a hand, said Mac. How's she look?
Fireball, said Eddie. They carried the case into the palace and Mac attacked it with a hand axe.
There she is, he said when the lid was off.
She's with Doc. Say, what you got?
Look, said Mac, and he and the boys gazed down on the instrument, the great black tube of an 8-inch reflector, eyepieces socketed beside it, and its tripod cradled.
Biggest one in the whole damn catalog, said Mac proudly.
Jesus, Doc'll be happy. Eddie, tell us everything that happened. Don't leave nothing out.
What a day it was. A day of purple and gold, the proud colors of the Salinas High School. A squadron of baby angels maneuvered at 1,200 feet, holding a pink cloud on which the word J-O-Y flashed on and off. A seagull with a broken wing took off and flew straight up into the air, squawking, joy, joy.
Susie was ahead of her racing feet when Eddie intercepted her. She answered yes and no to Eddie's casual comments on the weather, but not only did she not hear the comments, she didn't know Eddie was beside her. She went up the steps of Western Biological without seeing Whitey Number 2 standing guard with the sash weight. Her coming relieved him of a duty, but he stuck around to hear. At the top of the steps, Susie became a breathless, shy girl. And as anybody knows, there's nothing more indestructible and deadly than a shy young girl. She paused to get her breath, and then knocked on the door and went in and forgot to close the door, which was good for Whitey Number 2. Doc was sitting on his cot gloomily regarding the pile of collecting paraphernalia on the floor.
"I heard you was hurt,"
Susie said gently.
"I come to see if there was anything I could do."
For a moment, Doc's face lightened, then gloom descended. "This shoots the spring tides," he said, staring at the white cast. "I don't know what I'll do."
"Does it hurt much?" Susie asked.
"Some. It'll hurt more later, I guess."
"I'll go down to La Jolla with you."
"And turn over rocks that weigh 50 or 100 pounds?
"I ain't put together with spit," said Susie.
"Can you drive a car?"
"Sure," said Susie.
"You can't do it," he said, and then, from way down in the deep part of him, there came a bubbling shout. "Sure you can! I need you, Susie. I need you to go with me. It'll be terribly hard work, and I'm pretty near helpless."
"You can tell me what to do and what to look for."
"Sure I can, and I'm not entirely helpless. I can use my left hand."
"It's a cinch," said Susie. "When do we start?"
"I've got to go tonight. If we drive all night, we can make the tide at 7:18 tomorrow morning." "Think you can make it?"
"Cinch," said Susie, "if you need me."
"I need you, all right. I'd be lost without you. But you'll be a tired kid."
"Who cares?" said Susie.
"I want to ask you something," said Doc. "Old Jingle Bollocks has set up a foundation for me at Caltech."
"Why not?"
"I don't have to work there."
"Fine."
"I don't know whether I oughtn't to throw it in his face."
"Why don't you?"
"On the other hand, there's all the wonderful equipment."
"Fine," said Susie.
"I don't like to work for anybody."
"Give it back."
"But there's an invitation to read my paper before the Academy of Science."
"Do it then."
"I don't know whether I can even write the paper. What shall I do, Susie?"
"What do you want to do?"
"I don't know."
"What's wrong with that?"
"Say, Doc, I gotta do a couple of things. Take me maybe 2 hours. That too long?"
"Just as long as we can start by evening.
I'll come back soon as I finish."
Doc said, "Susie, I love you."
She was headed for the door. She whirled and faced him. Her brows were straight and her mouth taut. Then she took a slow breath, and her lips became full and turned up at the corners, and her eyes shone with incredible excitement.
"Brother," said Susie, "you got yourself a girl."
Chapter 40. I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings. In the palace flophouse, Susie sat on a straight chair surrounded by the boys. She wore a look of furious concentration. Her feet were on two bricks, and she held a barrel hoop in her hands. Propped in front of her was a board on which were chalked ignition key, speedometer, choke, and gas gauge. On the floor on her right side stood an apple box with a mop handle sticking upright out of it. "Try her again," said Mac. "Turn the key and reach up with your right toe for the starter." Susie put her foot on a chalk spot on the floor.
"Chuck, chuck, 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 chuck," said Hazel happily.
"Push out your clutch." Susie pushed her left foot down on a brick. "Now bring the gear to you and back." She moved the mop handle to low gear. "Ease up the gas and let in the clutch. Now clutch out, away from you and forward. Give it gas. Now clutch out, straight back. There! You done it good. Now do it again." At the end of an hour and a half, Susie had driven the straight chair roughly 150 miles. "You'll do all right," said Mac. "Take it slow. If you can get 2 miles out of town without ramming into something, you can tell him the truth. He ain't going to turn back then. He'll tell you what to do. I'll get her started and kind of lined up with the street."
"You're a bunch of nice guys," said Susie.
"Hell, if Hazel can go to all the trouble to break..." "Oop, sorry. The least we can do is see he gets some good out of it. Come on now, wang her through the gears again."
The evening was as lovely as the day had been. The setting sun pinked up the little white caps on the bay and lighted the serious pelicans pounding home to the sea rocks. The metal cannery walls seemed a soft and precious platinum. Doc's old car stood in front of Western Biological, its back seat loaded with buckets and pans and nets and crowbars. All Cannery Row was there. The patron had set out pints of old tennis shoes along the curb. Fauna's hair blazed in the setting sun. The girls gave Susie quick little hugs. Becky was in romantic tears. Joe Elegant looked out his lean-to door. He thought he would go to Rome after his book was published. Doc held a list in his hand and checked equipment. Only Mac and the boys were missing. And here they came, down the chicken walk, balancing among them the tripod and the long black tube. They crossed the track and the lot, and they set the tripod down beside the automobile. Mac cleared his throat.
"Friends," he said, "on behalf of I and the boys, it gives me pleasure to present Doc with this here."
Doc looked at his gift, a telescope strong enough to bring the moon to his lap. His mouth fell open. Then he smothered the laughter that rose in him.
"Like it?" said Mac.
"It's beautiful."
"Biggest one in the whole goddamn catalog," said Mac.
Doc's voice was choked.
"Thanks," he said. He paused. "After all, I guess it doesn't matter whether you look down or up. As long as you look."
"We'll put her inside for you," said Mac. "Give me one of them pints."
"To Doc,"
he cried, and under his breath he whispered to Susie, "Turn the key. Now, start her." The ancient engine roared. Doc was sipping from a pint.
"Clutch out. To you and back," Mac said. "Let in the clutch."
Susie did.
The old car deliberately climbed the curb, ripped off the stairs of Western Biological, careened into the street, and crawled away, scattering lumber as it went. Doc turned in the seat and looked back. The disappearing sun shone on his laughing face. his gay and eager face. With his left hand, he held the bucking steering wheel. Cannery Row looked after the ancient car. It made the first turn and was gone from sight behind a warehouse just as the sun was gone. Fauna said,
I wonder if I'd be safe to put up her gold star tonight. What the hell's the matter with you, Mac?
Mac said, Vice is a monster so frightful of mien, I'm sure we should all be as happy as kings. He put his arm around Hazel's shoulders. I think you'd have made a hell of a president, he said.
We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Sweet Thursday by John Steinbeck, read by Jerry Farden. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Claudia Howard. Sweet Thursday is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated and Recorded Books LLC, copyright 1989, all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.